Welcome to Answers Withheld, a podcast about the big questions that kids, and let's be honest, adults too, ask about God, Judaism, and our place in the world. We definitely do not have all the answers, but we hope we can help you with language and framework so you can engage meaningfully with these questions. I'm Rabbi Shai Helt. It's my great pleasure today to have with me my friend, my colleague, Rabbi Aviva Richman, to talk about the question of where is God when bad things happen. And Aviva, I wanted to have you here because I know you as someone who thinks incredibly deeply about religious and theological questions, and for whom being present with people when they're hurting is really important. So I thought this is a conversation, obviously one that is really difficult, that would be really great for us to have together. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's really an honor to be here with you as a colleague, also as my teacher. And this is hard. I'm not going to pretend it's not hard to think about this question together, but we have to do it, and I'm excited to do it with you.
So let me ask you, when did this question, where is God when bad things happen, when did it first emerge for you in your life?
Even though this question seems so pervasive, what I find strange and astonishing to me is that I have an extremely concrete memory of addressing this question personally and when it kind of took over me, which was in the tragedy of Waco, Texas in 1993. I remember so distinctly where I was. I was sitting on my bed, my kind of light blue bedspread. I can remember the color and the texture. I was at my dad's house that week. My dad was sitting next to me in our usual bedtime routine. And I was in tears. I couldn't understand what was happening. I didn't understand what a cult was. Couldn't understand how there could be so much violence right there in America. And what I remember most, the truth is, I don't think he even tried to really explain to me what was happening. The feeling that I have from it is that he did not have an answer. But the other feeling I have from it is that he was very close to me and had a comforting presence. And so I think what, you know, why that maybe stands out is because I was starting to realize that there was not really going to be an answer, and that my dad, who I trusted, would be with me nonetheless. So it was both comforting and unsettling. That's what I remember from that. And I remember being extremely distraught, just in tears.
And so would you say that the pastoral response, if you will, is more important than the theological, or was more important to you? Presence of your dad as opposed to a story about the world?
I think so, or at least if he told me anything else, the most compelling part of it was him being there. I don't want to say that in a way that shuts us down to try to look for language and frameworks, but I do think that we have to be, especially as I think about it as a parent now, that we have to be very aware. In some ways, I feel like a question underlying the question about where God is can I feel safe in this world? But especially for a kid. It's like, is it possible for me to feel safe? And so I think to be that reassuring presence, trying to convey that you will do whatever you can to help your kid feel safe, is sort of the subtext that might be more in body language and presence that is actually potentially responding to an underlying question.
Yeah, it feels to me like whether or not people always consciously feel this way, or whether or not they would even accept it, that being present with another person, with a child who is feeling perplexed in pain over this question, is a form of mediating God's presence to them. That on some level, we become the vehicle of God's compassion in those moments. And that's actually, you know, very powerful to me as both an image and an experience, right? At the end of the day, our sense of God is deeply shaped by our experience of our parents. L'tov v'l'ra, right? For good and for bad.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I also think the parental relationship is one place for that to play out initially. And it's obviously critical. And also, it's just a way of kind of modeling how that might be the way God shows up in general in relationships that aren't just the parent-child relationships. It does seem like, you know, you can't talk about imitatio Dei with your child and kind of complex ideas about we are instantiating God. We can't say all of that, but I think we can try to be that for them. And in doing that, hopefully they will also get the message, maybe subconsciously, that a way to respond to bad things happening in the world is to try to be there for other people themselves.
Yeah, I mean, an idea that is very, very important to me and has become more important to me over the years is something that you find a lot in 20th century Musser, which is the idea that real cleaving to God, real intimacy with God, the highest form of that is to be completely tapped into God's compassion. That when a person shows up in the deepest sense of that word for another person, that on some level is dvekut. That is what it means to have, if you will, a religious experience. The religious and the ethical there are totally non-disentangleable. They are really very much kind of intertwined. They may even be the same thing. So yeah, I mean, that resonates with me a lot. And I think it's a really heavy thought to live with, and yet also an incredibly beautiful one.
And essentially, it's sort of the beautiful side of the darker side of this, which is that when people are not exercising compassion or are exercising violence towards each other, they are essentially diminishing God's presence. They are kind of making God go away, so to speak. So I think those are two sides of a coin. And then I feel like the challenge is, what do you convey through language and what do you convey through presence when you're interacting with kids or with anyone?
With anyone, really, right. I mean, by the way, just to take this all the way back to the Torah for a minute, you have this amazing juxtaposition of psukim, of verses in Dvarim Perek Yud, in Deuteronomy chapter 10, where first God is described as Ohev Ger Latet Lo Lechem V'Simla, God loves the stranger and manifests that by giving the stranger food and clothing. And then the very next verse says, Vav Temetager, which in this context means, I think, you too must love the stranger because you are the means by which God provides food and clothing. In other words, you know, someone could read the first verse and say, I've never seen God drop food packages from the sky. So what does it mean to say that God feeds the stranger? And perhaps the answer is that verse 19 says, by commanding us, by summoning us, by inviting us to be the means by which God delivers compassion to the world. That's like a very, I think, powerful way of thinking about the theological dimension of all of our interpersonal relationships.
Okay, so I shared a little bit from what I remember. I'm actually very curious if you have a distinct memory of when this question first really struck you. Where is God when bad things happen?
So I have both an indistinct memory and an extremely distinct memory. The indistinct memory is that I grew up with parents who were European refugees, whose worlds were basically destroyed in the Shoah. It was a kind of undercurrent of my childhood. Not only were the Jews abandoned by the world, we were also abandoned by our God. My parents, I think, in some interesting way, were both believers who were furious. So the question of where is God when bad things happen was sort of like in the background of my childhood all the time. Very concretely, my father died very suddenly when I was 12 years old. He just went to sleep and didn't wake up. And on some level, that was the only question that I had at that moment, which was, what on earth just happened here? Where on earth is God? I mean, literally, where on earth is God, if anywhere? What, you know, how am I supposed to understand the world that I'm living in? And I'm not sure that I really had anyone in those days to talk about that question with, but it burned inside me. And then about 2 years later, a classmate of mine drowned in an accident. And then the questions became more articulate for me, meaning I started asking people. Like, I have a very distinct memory of calling a close friend of my family's and saying, why do you daven when you know very well that you could walk out of shul and get hit by a bus, and the fact that you davened will have made no difference? Like, I remember I think I was 14 or 15. And, you know, it's amazing the awakenings that you have. It was the first time anyone had ever said to me, oh, my praying really has very little to do with getting an outcome. It was like, yeah, I totally could get hit by a bus. That's not why I pray. And I don't remember what he said after that about why he did pray. And I remember at the time feeling, well, that's not good enough. That's a cop out. But yet, he had planted something in me that was like, oh, there can be more sophisticated ways or more complicated ways of thinking about and experiencing this.
Yeah, I was gonna ask, how did that land with you when he said that? It sounds like your feeling was, it's not satisfying. And yet, it sounds like that still, like that unsatisfyingness didn't sort of stunt your thinking or your engagement. It sounds like that kind of sat with you and kind of grew. I'm curious to hear about that.
In my high school years, I went in and out of being observant depending on how angry I was. When I got really angry, I would stop keeping mitzvot, and then it would soften a little, and I would get interested in mitzvot again, and then I would get angry again. It was like a whole process. But I think it was percolating in there somewhere. I think it's still percolating in there because I still find it hard. I still find the notion of petitionary prayer enormously challenging. Like, what is it that we're doing when we ask God for things? But yeah, I mean, his answer did open up a world for me. You know, I think that one of the complicated parts of having been a kid in yeshiva is that I didn't really know that there were other more sophisticated ways of thinking about theological questions than some of how it was presented to me by like my sixth grade Talmud teacher. Like, I just didn't really know that. So I had this series of moments as I got older where someone would say something to me and I would think, oh, you could think about Torah that way? I didn't really know that before. And again, even though the answer to this question I didn't find at the time helpful, I mean, to put it very bluntly, I wanted my father back. The notion that petitionary prayer was about something else was just uninteresting to me. It was like, well, then what's the point? Nothing else really matters to me as much as I miss my dad, right? So like, what are you giving me some convoluted, you know, oh, what we're doing is, that wasn't interesting to me. It became more interesting to me as I got older. And maybe one piece there is theology, when a person is in the midst of the sheer rawness of their pain, may just be the wrong conversation to be having. There was nothing he could have said. I mean, what could he have possibly said that would have made it more tolerable or bearable for me? But with some distance, I think some of that kind of discourse can be really important.
Yeah, I was thinking about how the process of finding language is maybe somehow parallel to a process of acceptance. You know, there's some initial thing that happens and there's rawness and there's anger and there's how could this be, right? How could this be in a world where we have some notion of God existing? And I think there can be a real kind of denial that's part of that. Like, could evil really be part of this world in such an extreme way? And in some ways, I think a lot of the theology piece, it's somehow doing the work of coming to accept that there is bad in the world, that there is loss. And, you know, and in that way, it's like it might not be intellectually satisfying, the language and framework that we land on, but it's somehow kind of accompanying us through a process of acceptance.
Yeah. And I think for many of us, at least, and this brings us right to the theme of this conversation, I think presence becomes almost an alternative to answers. And in this case, the presence of God, whatever we take that to mean, right? As opposed to a kind of vantage point or access to the divine mind. You know, why did God set up the world in such a way that X, Y, and Z? Instead, there's just, oh, God is here. Imo anochi betzara, right? I am here with you in your suffering and your pain. I have a very distinct memory. I was 18 years old. I was in yeshiva in Israel for the year. And a guy I knew not well at another yeshiva, his mother had a heart attack. And he said to a group of us, he literally said this. He said, I'm so sad this happened. If only I hadn't eaten non-hechshered pizza. And the absurdity of it, and yet the poignancy of it, overwhelmed me. Like, I remember thinking, even then, I remember thinking, imagine living in a world in which you could explain why something terrible happened. But then, oh my God, imagine living in a world in which God gave your mother a heart attack because you violated some technical point of halakha. Like, in other words, on the one hand, we have no choice on some level but to accept presence rather than answers. But rejecting some answers is actually enormously liberating.
Yeah. I actually think it's not only enormously liberating when we're thinking about interfacing with kids. There's sort of high stakes, right? Because we know that kids can jump to guilt very quickly and might not articulate it. Right? You're with an 18-year-old who could articulate that, right? But for a kid who might be in some situation where, like, they just want their father back but don't have language to fully describe anger and sadness, right? They might internally be going through all sorts of things of, oh, if only I had done this or this or this. I agree with you 100% that saying that we might not have great answers and that the importance is presence doesn't mean that what's happening in terms of communication and language is not important. It actually could be very important and might be more important for negating or responding to or kind of shifting out of where kids and, you know, all of us might go. It could be very important to do some of that work very explicitly.
Yeah, where I think this gets complicated is that we know that very often people will choose blame of themselves if that gives them what feels like a coherent universe. I mean, in Jewish liturgy, we say to this day, "Mipnei chataeinu galinu me'aretzeinu," because of our sins, we were exiled from our land. And on one level, it's a very disturbing theology, but forget about that. It's comforting if what you're looking for is order, right? And I always find that really hard. I mean, I think about this even in terms of raising my own kids. When is it important to admit the disorder and the chaos? And when is it important to give them the sense, perhaps even sometimes the illusion of order?
Yeah, but to go back to your pizza, oh, I did this wrong, that's why a bad thing happened. Or mipnei chataeinu galinu me'artzeinu, right? Wanting to ascribe our bad circumstances of exile to the Jewish people's sin, right? I actually think that the point of being in relationship with God is that we are in a breach. We're in a covenant, and there are certain expectations and responsibilities that we carry. And I feel like what I get stuck on is wanting to believe and maintain and transmit to my children two ideas that feel like they can be kind of at odds with each other, which is on the one hand, when bad things happen, that's not a punishment for, you know, the things that you as an individual did wrong, especially the minutia type things that you did wrong, right? To get out of that mindset of guilt. But at the same time, I do think we have to understand that the reason why some bad things happen, especially bad things that are at the hands of humanity, is because as people, we aren't doing the best. We aren't doing what we need to be doing.
I have this experience in parenting my daughter a lot. I'm constantly thinking about, I want you to feel safe. It is really important to me that you feel safe. And at the same time, I don't want to give you the illusion that this world is safe. And those things are, it feels to me, irreconcilable. Certainly on some abstract philosophical level, I have no way of reconciling it. I just know that my kids need to feel some sense of safety if they're going to function in the world. But I struggle with, am I giving them a sense that is in some sense misleading? And I really don't have an answer to that question. I mean, I think about this all the time.
I feel like that is sort of the root of this and the root of the parenting challenge behind it. And I don't know, maybe we can land on some other kind of North Star we're aiming for, which is like, I will do all that I can to try to help you be safe. You know, it's aspirational, because also it seems like creating the illusion of the world being a safe place makes one more prone to have a crisis at some point where the sort of curtain is pulled back.
What you just said reminds me of one of the most poignant scenes I've ever read. The sociologist Peter Berger talks in one of his books about the idea of signals of transcendence. That's his term. And he means by that, if I recall correctly, sort of moments that point to a reality that is transcendent. And the example that he gives that most stayed with me is he describes a mother picking up a crying child and saying, it's going to be all right. And he says, how does she know that? Maybe it's not going to be all right. The world is a dangerous place. And yet somehow the natural confidence with which a mother holds a child and says it's going to be all right points to some sense of assurance she has that there is something in this world. And I don't know how you finish this sentence.
Yeah. Well, I feel like you do know one way to finish the sentence in all of your work on divine love, meaning I can imagine, and I would say as a parent, I sometimes think about this. Am I going to say everything's going to be okay? Or am I just going to say I love you when I'm comforting the child? And they're actually different, but I think can convey a similar sense for the child.
Yeah, or I'm here.
Yeah, I'm here. Though I think that I love you is like I'm here and I'm invested in you. When I think about how this maps onto God, the idea that every day we would wake up in the morning and have to recite the same words about how God loves us. Ahava rabba ahavtanu, right? You love us deeply, right? The idea that we say that every day as a mantra, essentially, feels to me like what's happening in that moment is we are kind of letting God be that parent who is picking us up for a minute and holding us and sort of saying, you know, I love you, or conveying like there's some presence that is trying to hold you as you are going through your day. And that's not the same as everything's going to be okay. And when we do the petitionary prayer, you know, in some ways I feel like you can read the petitionary prayer against the grain, which is like if we're petitioning for it every day, it's because we haven't gotten it yet. And we know we're going to petition for it tomorrow, right? And in that way, it's like, yeah, there's not really an assumption behind the prayer itself that we won't need to keep asking for it, you know, that it's going to be satisfied. So I don't know if this is helpful or not helpful as a parent, but I sometimes think about how through my own work of parenting, I can maybe better understand God a little bit and how God interacts with us as some, you know, as a divine parent, obviously not in a totally linear way, but I do feel like some of the prayers I understand now differently, like through the lens of being a parent in general in life, and feeling like actually in prayer I kind of let myself be more the child for a little instant.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually very moving. A version of that that I think about sometimes is in moments of feeling lonely or underappreciated is I think about the famous line of Rabbi Akiva, Chaviv Adam Sheniv Ra B'Tzelem, beloved is the human being, you know, who was created in the image of God. And this is something that I've written about and talked about a lot over the years. The notion that God's love is not dependent on anything we could possibly do. Or to use a term that I'm trying to get Jews to reclaim, God's love is grace. We don't earn it. We just have it. And so the religious life becomes not about earning God's love, but about living up to it. But in a more pastoral sense, it's about tapping into the sense that it's never true that no one cares about me. It's actually never true because there is someone out there who always cares about me. And I think one of the most kind of interesting things that Tanakh is invested in is in underscoring the idea that God is, if you will, especially invested in those who most often feel uninvested in. Or to say that less abstractly, a God who loves widows, orphans, and strangers is a God who loves the forgotten. It's a God who sees the unseen. It's the God who sees Hagar, whose owners, and that word should, you know, give us pause, whose owners can't even acknowledge that she has a name. And then the angel shows up and the first word the angel says is Hagar, right? I see you.
Yeah. So I guess to bring this back into our theme of interfacing with a world while bad things happen, right? I think what we're trying to develop here is kind of fleshing out what it looks like to walk through that world with a sense of closeness to God, even though that doesn't mean there's some expectation of God intervening in a specific way to turn things suddenly with a magic wand to be better. I want to go back a little bit to what you were saying about chaos and how much we want to expose our children to what we may perceive as a reality of where is evil vis-a-vis God? Where is bad vis-a-vis God? Is God the God of everything, right? Borei et hakol? Or did God create evil in some way? Borei et hara? Or is evil outside of God? And actually, I've learned this from you, not directly, but from your writings and teachings a little bit. But when we read the beginning of the Torah, when we read the Genesis story in Bereshit, if we go to the beginning of the Torah, the beginning of the world, it seems like there's darkness, there's chaos, choshech, tohu vavohu, and God overcomes that in creating light, in creating order. But that's not the only story in the Bible, and it's not the only story in later Jewish traditions, right? There's also a story where it seems like there's an ongoing struggle with Tehom, the primordial waters of chaos, with this chaotic force. So there's a story about King David, he's digging the foundations of the temple and hits the Tehom. And then the Tehom kind of comes up and is going to flood the whole world. And the kernel of the story is that then he recites Psalms, Shir HaMaala, and the water goes down. And so that message is like prayer is here for us when we see bad, we see chaos and bad around us. Prayer is here. It almost has a kind of magical power. And God will intervene and tame the chaos around us. And that's the foundation of the temple, right? It's like the foundation of our relationship with God is this story. You encounter the chaos around you. You have this tool, which is your relationship with God. And God will, you know, through our prayer, God will kind of make everything okay. Right? That's one version of the story. But that's not the only version of the story. There's a few different versions of the story. And the one that I find most powerful is the one in the Babylonian Talmud as it continues, which is he dug down, the waters came up. There's this kind of bizarre story about him figuring out how to tame the waters by like throwing in this shard with God's name. But then the problem is the waters went too far down. So this chaos is sort of too far away from the surface. And so then he has to write these psalms, the songs of ascent, Shir HaMaalot, which are about bringing something up. And those raise the Tehom, right? Raise this water more so that they're sitting just below the surface. And that, I think, is actually extremely powerful because it says, oh, the purpose of prayer is not to reassure us that everything's okay. It's not to tame the chaos. It's not to sort of create a shield between us and the bad things around us in our world or in our lives. It's actually to like have a container to summon some of that a little bit closer. It's about creating an encounter and seeing some of that chaos that continues in our world. And somehow, right, I don't have an answer for how this is all supposed to work, but like somehow it's like a relationship with God through prayer contains that or holds us in that encounter. But the idea is not that God's role is actually just about making everything okay.
Yeah, I want to kind of almost underline something, Aviva, that you said, because I think it's actually one of the most poignant and painful issues in Tanakh, in biblical theology. On the one hand, you have texts that imagine that what it means for God to create the world is for God to subdue and defeat the forces of chaos. And then you get these other voices that say, defeat and subdue the forces of chaos. Have you looked around? And in response to that, you get these additional voices that say, oh, the defeat and subduing of chaos, that's not creation, that's redemption. And so the thing that was imagined to be the foundation for creating the world is now pushed off into some indefinitely far away future. It's kind of this amazing admission about how far short the world falls from what we think it ought to look like if it's a world that is God's. There is just something so moving about that. It doesn't lose faith exactly, but it grapples in the most raw way, I think, with, wait a minute, if this is God's world, why does it look like this? And it lives inside that question and it will not look away from it. That I just find to be so powerful. I was taught as a kid in yeshiva that the answer to almost every experience was Gamzula Tova. This is also good. You know, Tehillim, the Psalms just want no part of a Gamzula Tova theology. When something is horrible, you know what a good religious response is? Declare it horrible, or even bring its horribleness to God. That depends on a God who can handle it and on a God who's there to hear it.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that is, huge. In Tehillim, obviously in Eicha, the sacred words that are just there to name and confront and describe a sense of tragedy and anger and desperation, right? The fact that you could utter all of those emotions in Lashon Kodesh, meaning like actually through the words that are
right
in the Tanakh, I do think that's really, you know, and sometimes we sort of take that for granted, but it's not to be taken for granted at all. I know personally in recent months, that's been incredibly important to just sit with words of Tehillim and allow myself to be in a space of just total anguish and desperation at what's happening in our world.
Tell me a little bit about, what does God do? Does God intervene in Aviva Richmond's life? Does God intervene in the world?
So this is where I feel, you know, in some ways I would say, well, I have no idea. But we have the Torah and our, you know, Chazal and all these traditions and Midrashim that are ideas about what God does. Actually, the parenting journey can be intense in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. And in so many different stages. So for me, what does God do? I feel like I came to a different approach to that, again, by virtue of an experience, which was my particular experience around pregnancy loss and a loss of a twin, which meant carrying the lost fetus until the living baby was born. And walking around like knowing that you're holding a little bit of death inside of you, it's like, it's very intense. Like, being a parent asks a lot of us, even when everything goes relatively smoothly, quote unquote. I mean, just what it asks of us, the kind of capacities and ways it stretches us it's so huge. And I guess I feel like, and I think that's part of the story of us understanding what God does. I know for me personally, what I kind of ended up coming to was a sense that one thing God does is God holds loss. God holds all the loss in the world. That is just something God is holding constantly. And, you know, we sort of bury the dead in the ground generally and kind of don't want to hold that loss quite so close. But in some ways, I feel like that means we're giving that loss to God to hold. And I feel like I had this experience. This was both very difficult, but also felt like a certain kind of, I don't know, it's weird to use this language. It was sort of an honor in a way to feel like, oh, I'm participating in the work of holding loss for a few months here in a very embodied way. And so now, you know, I don't know if that's satisfying at all, but I do feel like, again, not in the level of language. And this is why I wouldn't say it's an idea. It's like an embodied experience of one aspect of the divine, right? When we say we're supposed to be like God, Bahalachta Bidrachav, it's actually an amazing piece in this. In Rav Huttner, B'Hachad Yitzchak talks about, right, God holds life and death. And I felt like, okay, I can hold life and I'm holding life and death in this moment. And it doesn't make it easier to think of that as part of God's work, but I do think it at least honors the experience. And so I think, you know, there's such a range of different kinds of bad things that happen. And certainly the things that sort of happen more naturally versus things that happen because of human evil can feel different. But I think if God is there just kind of holding all of this all at once, then somehow our relationship with God and wanting to be like God should give us the fortitude to just kind of hold some of that that's happening in the world when it happens. And then, you know, if it's like, well, what do we do with that? What do we do with that knowledge? Like somehow I think it just has to come back to God holds all of that, and somehow God is entirely chesed, right? Is entirely a force for love. We just have to figure out how to try to be that in some way.
First of all, thank you for sharing that. It's really incredibly moving. That brings me back to where I started with this notion in Musar that compassion is the highest form of dvekut. Compassion is cleaving to God. And I will say that I do have some intuition of the reality of this. I wouldn't say that I experience it all the time. But when I grow in compassion, my ability to perceive the presence of God, my perception of God's presence grows. And the converse is true too. The more constricted I grow, the more closed off I become, the more the world feels stripped of God's presence. There is some really deep way in which our openness to others is on some level, whether we want it to be or not, how open or not open we are to God. You know, Hasidim come close to saying this when they say in this wonderful comment on Psalm 121, Hashem tzilcha al yad yaminecha, God is your shadow by your right hand. And they play with the image of Hashem tzilcha to mean that however you are in the world is how God is to you. So if you are forgiving, God is forgiving to you. The rabbinic notion of, right, as a person is merciful, God becomes merciful to them. And you can think of that as a kind of reward and punishment scheme, but I think much more deeply, it's a deep psychological truth, right? You can't go through the world closed and say, oh, but I have a profound sense of the presence of God. You can't just turn openness on and off.
No, I don't know if it's a cop-out. If it's like, well, give up on God doing anything in the world. You just get your act together and start to do good things yourself. Like, I don't know if that's a cop-out, but I do think it's a very deep message of what God is trying to teach us.
I want kids to think that whether or not they respond compassionately to suffering is of the utmost significance, capital U, capital S. That's the deepest statement of the theology, of the only theology that matters, right? I mean, at the end of the day, someone says, I believe in God and goes through the world constricted and with a closed heart. So what does that even mean? What's the value of that? Like, I want them to believe that, to kind of maybe use a different way of saying the same thing you just said, that they have the power to mediate God's love to other people. The same way that you and I as parents have learned that we have the power to mediate God's love or to block it. Right? I mean, we also have the power to block the experience of God's love from children. That's very daunting, right? But I want my kids to have in their relationships the same sense that I have in my relationship with them. That's on some of what we're doing, I think. That's what it means to prepare children for life, is to teach them to love.
Yeah. And so then I think the sort of part of that work that gets done when confronting questions about where is God when bad things happen is kind of building up more resilience around their readiness to do that work. To not right. have that throw you off course entirely, but to kind of feel even more adamant about, you know, what my role is as somebody who's part of the covenant of Bnei Israel and God, right? Part of that whole picture, right? When bad things happen, I feel even more adamant about my work going forward as trying to manifest more of God's chesed.
So Aviva, after all that we've talked about, very concretely, for parents who want or need to have a conversation with their kids about where God is when bad things happen, what very concretely would you tell them?
This may sound like what I would always tell any parent about anything, but I do think listening is huge. Just listening to what your child is saying, how they're asking the question. What question are they asking? What question are they not asking or not right. asking yet? And I think you can also ask them questions. Are you feeling afraid of something? What are you feeling afraid of? So I think there's that. I think that there might be, depending on the situation, choosing your words a little bit carefully. Am I going to say everything will be okay? Am I going to say, I'm here with you when I love you? And then I just think not feeling the pressure to rush to an answer that doesn't mean anything to you will not. You know, that's not necessarily going to help your child. So I feel like, you know, if you can listen to yourself also as you're speaking to your child and say something that does feel resonant, it can save perhaps work in the future of kids feeling like they were lied to or weren't really listened to. What would your advice be?
I think one thing I might say is that the conversations when that is the explicit topic are often less important than the moments in life when there's tragedy and when you model what a response to it would look like. I don't mean in any way to downplay the importance of discussions of God or theology. That's actually kind of the point of the podcast. But on some level, what kids learn from Moore is when they're faced with fear, when they're sitting on the bed thinking about what happened in Waco, right? What does their father do, right? Or does their parent do, or their caretaker? That's what you told us about, right? So I think that's one thing I would say. And the other thing, which, you know, I've come back to again and again over the course of recording these conversations, is don't pretend to know things that you don't know, and trust your kids' ability to hold that a question is hard even for you. Like, I've tried to tell my kids in countless ways, there's so many questions about God I don't begin to have an answer to. And that's okay. I still get out of bed in the morning. I still go about my day. I still think about the things I think about. So I think there's something about trusting kids to live with uncertainty about philosophical questions may actually be a good thing and a way of showing respect for them. Don't offer them tied up in a bow something that is totally an open question for you. Rabbi Aviva Richman, thank you so, so much for joining me. This conversation has been incredibly rich and powerful, and so thank you for your honesty, for your insight, and for your presence.
Thank you. This was really an honor, even if it feels like we're just scratching the surface.
To all of you listening, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you'll join us next time for another installment of Many Questions and Answers Withheld. Answers Withheld is produced by Hadar, with special thanks to Rabbi Effie Unterman, Mara Bronfeld, Sam Greenberg, and Chana Kupitz. Thank you to David Chabinsky for recording and editing this episode.